from sea to shining sea throughout the solar system and extending to interstellar regions beyond. This is the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth.
Comments and views expressed on the Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, the Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We have one more quick reminder here before we get into tonight's show, which, by the way, I think is going to be absolutely fascinating. And the reminder is that one of the things that happens in our members' community is that each month I go into the chat room and hang out for a couple of hours. And I do that on the first Saturday of the month. Well, that's tomorrow. So at showtime, look at your clock, and wherever you are on the planet, right at this time, right now, tomorrow night, you come into the chat room in the members community. I'll be hanging out there for a couple of hours, and we always have a great time, and I hope you'll be there. And like I said, you know, if you're not a member, no one but you can cure that. Click where it says join. And look, it's $7.50 for a month. That comes out to 25 cents a day. Okay? That's all. One time I got an email from someone that wanted to know if we bill 25 cents every day. And no, we don't. Okay. It's $7.50 for the month. But if you divide that by 30, you get 25 cents a day. My guest this evening is Dr. Courtney Brown. I think probably almost everyone in our genre knows of Dr. Courtney Brown. But in case you don't, and in case you have perhaps a little bit of an incomplete knowledge about Dr. Courtney Brown, let me give you a few, and these are only a few, facts about this amazing individual. 1982, he earned his PhD in political science from Washington University with an emphasis on mathematical modeling. He's taught at the college level in Africa, at UCLA, at Emory University, and at the Inter-University Consortium for Political and Social Research. Dr. Courtney Brown is also a longtime actor and singer, and he has acted in a number of lead roles in television series and films, both in the United States and in Africa. He has also written a number of published books, and he is the founder of what you probably are most familiar with him about, and that is the Farsight Institute. One of the premier, if not the premier, remote viewing institutes on the planet. And he's the founder and director of that. And we are delighted to have him with us this evening. Dr. Courtney Brown, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Kevin, thank you so much for that very warm introduction also.
You're certainly welcome. And but all I did was state the facts.
I might mention that You mentioned that we're the premier venue for remote viewing research. What basically that means is we're really the only science shop dealing with remote viewing anywhere. We have the largest footprint on the internet with regard to remote viewing studies. We do scientific research on remote viewing, using remote viewing, finding out things with remote viewing, scanning the realm from what is the nature of physical reality to investigations about things that are off-planet. So everything from physics, quantum mechanics, to the nature of physical reality, to investigations of mysteries, we're doing. And we're the only place where we have these scientific projects that we publish them with all the details associated with them on the internet. So this is very unlike what you get with a lot of people who are often quite good doing their own thing, but talking about remote viewing anecdotally, what they did, what they've done, because what we do is scientific research, and scientific research should best be understood in terms of the university, in terms of the state of Missouri, which has its motto, its slogan being "Show Me," meaning you should never trust or take for the word of anyone, be they a scientist, a celebrity, or anyone. You should always be saying, "Show me the data." But that's the nature of scientific research. So what we do is some of the most amazing, far-reaching scientific studies that you can imagine. We'll cover some of those today this interview.
I've got a question for you.
They're all based on stuff that everyone in your audience can verify. You don't have to take my word for anything. We have all the details published. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've got a question for you here, and that is, quite obviously, you have tremendous accomplishments academically and professionally as a college professor, university professor. You've got tremendous accomplishments as an actor and singer. So how does someone like you, how did someone like you, get involved with remote viewing?
That's interesting. Back in the 1990s, when I first heard about remote viewing, I was just a professor. And I should mention from the very outset that I do not do any remote viewing research at my university. I teach at Emory University in Atlanta. I teach mathematics and statistics courses mostly in a social science department. I'm an applied mathematician. So I don't do anything related to remote viewing there. Everything I do related to remote viewing is done outside of the university at the Farsight Institute. By the way, that's spelled F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeing far. Mm-hmm. By the way, the website I should mention also for those who want to know where we are and the iWorld, it's farsight.org, www.farsight, like seeing far, .org. And when I first heard about remote viewing, I had recently gotten tenure, and I heard from a number of people who were coming out from a military project that was housed in the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. That included people from generals on down who were involved in this program, and the program was getting ready to be declassified and be made public. They were getting ready to close it down because they knew it was going to become known. I was never in the military. I was in the Peace Corps, in fact, so that's where I did my service. But nonetheless, the military people were coming out. And when I heard about it, I investigated it, and I said, look, it doesn't matter whether I'm a university professor or not. If this thing's real, I'm going to investigate it as thoroughly as possible. Since then, what I have done, I not only became a remote viewer, I learned the methods themselves. That's very unlike most academics. Most academics think in terms of not doing it themselves, but studying it from afar using statistics and things like that. I felt that in order to understand the processes well, in order to understand when other people did them, that I had to actually learn them. And So I published two books during those initial phases. One was called Cosmic Voyage, and the other was called Cosmic Explorers. And they were investigations of the application of remote viewing to extraterrestrial life. And they were actually bestsellers. But they actually occurred before we really understood how profound the inside workings of remote viewing actually was. So around the mid-90s, we started the Farsight Institute because we wanted to study it scientifically. The board of directors for the Farsight Institute includes Glenn Wheaton, retired Special Forces, military intelligence, and he runs the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild. And then we also have Lynn Buchanan, who is the lead teacher in the subject of controlled remote viewing, and that was originated by Ingo Swan. And that came out of DIA, not Special Forces with Glenn Wheaton, but DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. And each of those different, and the one that came out of Special Forces, from which Glenn Wheaton came out of, that was an unofficial. You might call it a movement within the Special Forces branch, and the intellectual giant that inspired the group was a guy called Richard Ireland, Dr. Richard Ireland. In the DIA branch, the military program was an official program, and the intellectual giant on that side, the person who inspired the methods that were developed there, was Ingo Swan. So they had different components, different areas of the military doing different things. But Glenn Wheaton and Lynn Buchanan are the huge people on the block in terms of teaching remote viewing. And also we have Bruce Kaufman, who's an academic at Georgia State University, and myself. And so in terms of the board of directors. And what we do is we do research, we do projects, and some of our research has been published in the leading peer review journal. So, in fact, we just had an article published just a month ago in the Journal for Scientific Exploration, the leading journal, and it's peer-reviewed fully, and it features these people. Now, the people that do the remote viewing are not the military people. They were trained by the military people. So these are second-generation remote viewers that I call military-grade remote viewers. Now, when we do studies, we don't, you know, remember old Missouri, show me state. We don't just say, our viewers saw this. What we do is we show all the sessions, identify the viewers, full track records going back, you know, years are available for each of the viewers so the public can know how good they are, what they do. We only work with the best viewers, and their track record is as a matter of public record, so you know what they can do and what they can't. So this is very unlike hearing someone get up and say, trust me, our viewers saw this in the future. We don't do anything like that. We say, these are the data, and this is what they say, and these are the viewers, and these are the scientific conditions under which we collected these data, and now you decide. And so what we hope to do is actually educate the entire populace of the whole planet into a whole variety of the most amazing things that you can imagine. And we're not going to do that by having one person stand up and say, this is what we found out. We're going to do that by saying, these are all the different aspects of what we found out. These are the data, these are the sessions, these are the people, we did it, these are the controls we used, isn't this amazing? You decide. And by educating the public that way, we're going to have a permanent, long-lasting change in the way humanity looks at itself, the nature of physical reality, and its own evolution on this planet. So that's our really bottom line. So anyway, that's what we do at the Farsight Institute.
All right, so you sort of... You got into remote viewing first, I guess, just from curiosity, hearing about it.
Absolutely. Then once I found out it was real, mm-hmm. It went from there.
All right. Now, where is the Farsight Institute located? Is it in a particular location, or is this people scattered throughout the world and connected by internet, or how do you do this?
That's a very common question. We have such a huge presence that people often ask, where are we? They just assume we have this huge building downtown Atlanta or something like that. The reality is we used to actually have facilities, but we don't anymore because everybody's scattered around. A lot of our remote viewers are in Britain, all throughout the United States, including Hawaii. There's going to be new training that's occurring in other countries. So this is, we are an iFacility. Just like you have an iConference coming up, that's a very interesting iConference. Well, we are an iFacility. We connect, we have conference calls using Skype, and we have the state-of-the-art equipment to bring us all together. We use video for all sorts of things to connect ourselves. And so we do not have a physical facility, but I do understand how confusing it is, because when you go to our website, when you see all the stuff we do, and there's nothing similar anywhere else, you just assume we are in a building like we're IBM, next to the IBM building downtown Atlanta, but we're not. We're in the iWorld.
Well, I should say one more thing about being an academic. I mean, we're all used to that now. I mean, here at the Kevin Smith Show, our main person in doing our member support is not in the United States, but in Sweden. The main person handling the paranormal section of our forums is in the, I believe he's in the Phoenix, Arizona area. I know he was at one time. I think he's still there. But we're more of an entity than a facility. And I guess that's what you're describing as well.
Yeah, and, you know, people assume also because I'm an academic, academics have buildings and we're associated with universities, that assumes that everything's in a building and you have to go there. But the reality is, if we were physically located in any one spot, we decided about this many years ago, if we're physically located, we have to physically have people travel to us, and that's very expensive, and it immediately limits our impact on the planet. So we decided to have the most modern internet connectivity possible so that people have access to what we do. I should also say that I can say, and this is not boasting, you'll understand why when I say it, when I explain it, I am, and remember, this is not boasting, I am the leading academic that studies the subject of remote viewing as it is performed using the exact military-developed procedures used and developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes, or procedures that are derived from those procedures. Why can I say I am the leading scholar? Because I am the only one, Kevin. Believe it or not, the most amazing thing is there is absolutely not a single other academic anywhere in the university life that does what I do, and this is so amazing. Now, you could say, well, then they all look at me and say, are you deluded? Well, actually, it's not. If you look at the data, you realize how much of academia is deluded. And as we get further on into this program, I hope to explain to you some of the nature of what we have found out about not only some things which your audience may be interested in, such as a real operational base on Mars, the exact location, pictures, and what's going on, everything, but also the nature of physical reality and why you should understand that remote viewing is real. It's very normal for all of your listeners to say, why should I believe this? Because it is so contradictory to normal everyday experience. However, if I have a chance to explain it, and I can do it briefly, it will not only explain why remote viewing can exist, but you will then understand how amazingly deluded mainstream science and the entire university establishment is with regard to some really hugely basic fundamental issues.
Okay, we will do that, but we have to step away for break first. And when we come back from break, I'll ask you to jump in right there and just explain some of that to us. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Courtney Brown this evening, and we will... Welcome back. We are talking with Dr. Courtney Brown this evening, And we are talking about the work of the Farsight Institute. Now, just before we went to break, Dr. Brown dropped on us a little tidbit of information about Mars, and we are going to get into that. But first, I want to hear the explanation about the reality of how all this works. And Dr. Brown, if you will, just pick up there and move forward. The mic is yours.
Well, that's great. You know, that's so important, because once you realize how it works, you can then understand the importance of the results that we get. And even, for example, we'll talk about the fully operational base that's on Mars. And because as soon as I start talking about that, the very first question that's going to happen is people will listen to it, and then they'll say, well, they'll talk to someone else and say, yeah, that's just malarkey. How can remote viewing work in the first place? That's crazy. But if they understand how real it is and how deluded other people are when they don't understand why it works, then they can say, oh, wow, there really is a problem of understanding out there, and this base is real. So let's go to what it actually is. In the realm of physics, and this is the important thing to understand, there is two realms. There is the quantum realm, and then there is the classical realm. The quantum realm is the realm of the very small subatomic particles, atoms, things like that. The classical realm is you and me, our houses, things like that, our computers. And physicists draw a line between the two. And they say everything that happens in the quantum world, it's like what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in the quantum world stays in the quantum world, and it doesn't affect what happens in the big world. And what happens in the quantum world is really, really interesting, because the actions that occur with remote viewing match what happens in the quantum world. And normal experience, normal observation says, no, it really doesn't. Our physical world is really different from the quantum world. So something's got to be wrong. Either the remote viewing's wrong, or the explanations of what's happening in the classical world has got to be wrong. But this is the basic idea. Physicists will agree that everything that exists, all subatomic particles are made up of frequencies. There is no such thing as matter. Now, physicists will actually come back to you and say, oh, no, there is matter. But if you ask them more, they'll say, well, E equals mc squared. Energy equals mass times the speed of light. So energy and mass are equivalent. But what really is important is that they will all agree that at the quantum level, or the very small level, everything is the result of frequencies. Now, all of the universe is composed of frequencies. These are waves that are interacting, like waves on the ocean, but really small things. And they are interacting. And when waves bunch together through a process known as constructive and destructive interference, when they bunch together, they produce something like a snake that has eaten a rat. So if a snake eats a rat, what you see is there's a lump in the snake. Well, that lump in the snake is like the fabric of reality, and that lump in the snake is when all the frequencies bunch together to produce that lump in the space-time reality. So that lump is actually called something called a superposition, where all the waves interact. Well, that lump is a particle. The particle exists within that lump, but it doesn't exist as a real thing. It exists as a probable thing within that lump space. Now, this is the interesting thing. Physicists will say that on the quantum level, things exist in a probable state until they're observed. That means you and me in the classical realm have to actually see something, or actually register in some way through a photographic plate or something, in order for things to pop out of that probabilistic ether of nothingness into a real thing, such as when a photon hits a photographic plate and becomes a real thing and actually makes a mark on the photographic plate. Now, that should strike you as weird, because that's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, and that was pioneered and really championed by Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg, who had the idea that it took somebody in the big world to make something in the micro world pop out and become real. However, this postulate that they used, they would consider it a scientific postulate, is called the collapse of the wave function. But it is not a scientific postulate. It's a theological postulate. It's actually a belief. Because what they were trying to do is they agreed that the quantum world is made up of these nebulous probability things, but they insisted that the real world was unique, was physical, had physical mass, and existed in real space. But all of the physical world was based on the quantum world, which is all just probability, which is all just frequencies. So what they didn't want to do is to come up with an interpretation that would say that their macro world, the one that contains you and I, is also probabilistic, is also a wave. So you see, when the microwaves combine and produce this subatomic particle, well, you put a bunch of them together, you have atoms, and a bunch of the atoms together, you have you and I. What they didn't want to say is that we are the same as the quantum stuff, although we are made up of the quantum stuff. So even their own students said, this is crazy, this is ridiculous, you can't really keep going. But they did. They had an intellectual presence, and they kept going. This all changed around the mid-1950s, and in particular 1957, when Hugh Everett, who was a graduate student at Princeton University studying under a physicist named John Wheeler, wrote a dissertation in which he came up with an interpretation of quantum mechanics that was called many worlds. Some people call it other universes, multiple universes, parallel reality. But the basic idea is that all of us have wave functions that define us. It's not just the subatomic particles that have wave functions, but all of us. And there is even a wave function for the entire universe. That means that we all exist in a probabilistic netherland, like an ether, and that means there is infinite versions of us. So, Kevin, I'm going to ask you a question. What color shirt do you wear right now?
Well, it's very light blue.
Okay. Well, according to this theory, there's another version of you talking with me on this radio show where, in reality, you have a red shirt on or a turquoise shirt on or whatever, a white shirt on. The point is that there are many different versions of us. Now, in the early days, this was scoffed at. However, if you look at physics, that is the real growth industry. No one's really growing or championing the Copenhagen interpretation anymore. What's happening is that Hugh Everett's understanding of the other worlds is really growing. The young physicists, both graduate students and the younger generation faculty, are so excited about this. And even mainstream people like Brian Greene, the physicist, he's even just written a book, The Hidden Realities, where they're talking about this nature of reality being different from what we actually experience, that it's not just us physical. Now, physicists have never, ever been able to discover anything that's solid. You can say, well, what do you mean? They have particles. They shoot them into cancer patients and destroy cancer. But fields resist displacement. Fields resist displacement. So the point is that they've never found anything solid. The only thing they think is when they get a particle, it breaks into other particles. But they've never observed like a billiard ball solid thing. And Henry Stapp out at the University of California, Berkeley, identifies the few physicists that still exist that are looking for real solid particles as particleists. But everybody else says it's just frequencies. Now, this is the key. If we are frequencies, if we have a wave function that's associated with us, if we are made up of subatomic particles, atoms, molecules, then in reality, you and I, Kevin, are vast and complex superposition ensembles. Imagine so many zillions of superpositions all put together, and we are in a superposition ensemble. And that means we are frequency-based, not solid-based. And if that's true, us, the version of ourself, exists in a probable lump like that rat that's in the middle of the snake, just like everything else. And that explains why there's different versions of us. But one thing I will say is, why then, if there's zillions of different versions of us, why then is it that we only see one? Now, Einstein used to mock his quantum mechanics colleagues by saying, you guys are so stupid. Do you really think the moon would not be there if I didn't look at it? But, you know, this is something that Hugh Everett actually wrote to Bryce DeWitt when he published a short version of his dissertation in 1957. He said, you know, back in Copernicus's day, people said, how can the Earth move around the sun? How can the Earth move around the sun? I don't feel it moving. Well, the theory was not sufficiently complete for people to understand why they don't feel it moving. Just because we don't see these other realities doesn't mean that they don't exist. So this is the key. Why then is it that we only see one reality? Why don't we see the others? And why don't we see the past anymore? When we started this interview, where did the past go? And what about the future? Why can't we see that? This is the key. Our brains. Our brains have evolved to be very sophisticated, narrow-band hologram generators. Our brains are designed to pick out the frequencies that we perceive. If we're out there in the outback, primitive, without technology, you know, thousands of years ago, and we're confronted with a lion, we have to see that lion or we're going to be eaten. We don't really need to see the gazelle that was there yesterday or the elephant that will be there tomorrow. We need to see the lion that's there right now. So our brains have evolved to be very narrow band hologram generators. They pick out the frequencies that they want us to perceive, and they show us only those, and they lock into those. It's exactly like your radio, where you tune into a particular frequency for a station, and you can sort of say, well, what do you mean there's other stations? I don't hear any other stations. I only hear the station I'm listening to. And you say, well, you're not tuned into the other stations. So the brain is a very narrow-band hologram generator. It picks out the frequencies, and thus you see only one reality. Now, this is the key. You can dial, if you know how to do it, you can dial another frequency on your radio and hear another station. What remote viewers do, and typically our remote viewers train for an average of 10 years or more to become really good. I mean, anyone, for example, can bang on the piano and make noise, but if you want to play in Carnegie Hall, you've got to practice and become really good. Well, that's what these people are with regard to remote viewing. They have studied these military procedures or military-derived procedures. They have become military-grade remote viewers. And what they are capable of doing is very similar to the radio. They can tune the dial. What they are capable of doing is, since the reality of us are actually vast superposition ensembles, that means we exist as frequencies, like a bulge in a rat, not in just one little thing, but in a bulge. We can, if we train ourselves, perceive the other things that exist within the bulge. That means we are within the bulge. And if we train our minds not to be so narrow in the perspective of what it perceives, but if we train our minds to expand the frequencies so that we can pick up other things, we can do anything. We can perceive these other things. And these remote viewers, there's very few of them on the planet. There's like 20 of them that have become really good like this. And so these remote viewers have done these things. Now, with these remote viewers that we work with, public track records, everything scientifically verified, squeaky clean scientific procedures, we have investigated a huge project that we did called the Multiple Universes Project, and the data for that project were just published in the Journal for Scientific Exploration, and you can actually see that article free. It's a peer-reviewed article, the first of its kind ever using military-grade remote viewers like this, and you can see that if you go to our website, www.farsight.org, F-A-R-S-I-G-H-T, like seeing far.org, and underneath there's a big banner in the front with a picture of a face, and that's with regard to a DVD that we have that summarizes a lot of the work we do. You'll see something that says the latest peer-reviewed published research, remote viewing the future. If you click on that, you'll be able to read the article for free.
Okay, we have to step away for break, but we'll pick up right there when we come back. Don't go away, folks. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Dr. Courtney Brown. I had to cut you off right in mid-sentence because of the break taking over, so let me give you the opportunity to finish your comment, your thought. Sure. There. You were telling folks how they could get a copy of this peer-reviewed article.
Yeah, the peer-reviewed article can be found for free right on our website, www.farsight.org. Latest peer-reviewed published research, remote viewing the future, that's the banner to click on. And then you'll see the article and you can just read it. And you get to see who the reviewers were, you get to see the data, you get to see... And that very interesting article, because I hope to be able to explain a little bit about some of the things that we've discovered here, which is how to remote view the future. Because remote viewing the future has always been dicey. We actually finally figured out what was going on to be able to remote view the future, because it's always been so difficult in the past. Remote viewing the past and remote viewing the present has always been, you know, easily done. You understand that remote viewing is a mental procedure where trained remote viewers can actually perceive, you know, vague and foggy images, and sometimes really clear images, but they can actually perceive things that are at different times and different locations. All remote viewing is done totally blind. Never, ever, ever is a remote viewer told what they're supposed to perceive. They go into a room without any information at all about what they're supposed to do. They just have a stack of paper and a pencil, and they just, or pen actually, and they just start doing it. An hour later, they come out with 20 pages of detailed data of what the target is, and the target's the thing they're supposed to be perceiving. And our remote viewers, these descriptions are really good under a whole variety of different interesting experimental designs.
Okay, so I've got a question about this now. This is very interesting, because you're saying with different terms and phrases something that I have said many times, and I've said it to physicists on this show, and that is that if E equals MC squared, then it has to be possible to square C. Else,
it has. Go ahead.
Yeah, you can't. If you can't do MC squared, if you can't square the speed of light, then what you've got is a formula that may theoretically produce energy, but certainly cannot in reality produce energy. But,
well, go ahead.
Okay, but because E equals MC squared is a possibility, the entire universe then is energy.
Yes, this is absolutely very important to understand, that the C squared part of the E equals MC squared is a scaling factor. C is a constant. Squaring a constant is still a constant. So it's a scaling factor. So it's like the slope of a line. But the basic line, what you're actually saying with E equals M, just forget about the scaling factor. You're saying energy equals mass, meaning mass is just another way to talk about energy. They are exactly equivalent.
I've also said that frequency is the name of the game, and that every wave, every frequency,
exactly,
is giving
right
off harmonics in tangential fashion. It's not running parallel to the frequency, it's running tangentially to the frequency.
That's exactly right.
And therefore, and those are frequencies, those harmonics are frequencies that themselves are giving off harmonics. Therefore, what you wind up with, you called it superposition, and I said what you wind up with is a big ball of frequency, a sphere of frequency, where everything is where everything is interconnected.
Yes, they interact. And so basically frequencies interact through a very simple process, which is where a peak of one frequency hits the peak of another. They sum together and produce a bigger peak. And where a peak hits the trough, they cancel each other out and flatten out. So that's called deconstruct. So you have constructive interference and deconstructive interference, or interference that cancels. So it's just the opposite of that.
Okay, so but here's the
basic
question
idea
that's
is
based
when those two
on that,
processes
though.
Meet, you produce things like the bulge and the snake.
Yeah. Okay, but here's the question based on what you were saying. When remote viewers are viewing basically through this superposition or this bulge, how can they distinguish between what is they're seeing is past or future?
Yeah, that's very interesting. What we have learned to do at the Institute is advance our understanding of how to define a target, how to get the remote viewer to focus his or her perceptions on one and only one spot. For example, why did they only remote view if the target is the Eiffel Tower? Why are they not remote viewing Big Ben? Why are they not remote viewing the Capitol building in Washington, D.C.? How did it actually focus that? And so what we have found out is that in the process of remote viewing, there is actually, since everything is frequency, all frequencies can be connected up, there is a telepathic link during the process of remote viewing between the person who's doing the remote viewing in that room with a piece of paper and whoever analyzes the session for the first time. That person is the reason the remote viewer is doing the session, meaning the remote viewer is doing it for the intent of satisfying the informational needs of that so-called analyst who's analyzing the data with the actual target. And if we have found out that if that person changes his or her thoughts to start thinking about another thing, the remote viewer will actually start thinking about that other thing. It's complicated, but we have learned how to control all of that so that our studies are really, really precise. You get a level of precision in our studies that is absolutely phenomenal. You have to see it to believe it. I should mention that we have just recently put out, it became such a big thing for people to come to us and say, where do I start? I just am overwhelmed. You guys are doing something that's not happening anywhere. Where do I start? And so finally we said, I was presenting this work at university settings all over the world. I travel all over the world to present these things to groups of Nobel physicists. I mean, everything at various university settings, prestigious universities. I present this stuff, and what happens is it's just overwhelming to anyone who just starts it. So we decided to come out with a DVD, which explains our four big recent projects, and in one DVD, so people can hit the ground running and saying, wow, I get it now, I get it. And the DVD is actually called The Farsight Experiments. The Farsight Experiments. And there's a picture of it right on the homepage of our website, The Farsight Experiments. And you'll see that, and if you click on the picture of the, it's a picture of a face, with the Farsight Experiments on it, click on that. You'll see the thing for the DVD. Everything we have is sold through Amazon, so it's easily obtainable. And in that DVD, we have four major projects. Now, here are the projects. The first is the Multiple Universes Project. The data of which are actually part of the article that I just referenced you to, that you can see for free on our website. So the Multiple Universes Project, it was designed to discover if, in fact, there are multiple realities, and the results are incredibly positive. There are. And the second is there is a major project in the DVD called about an operational base on Mars. And I think you want me to actually talk about that. It's a real live base on Mars. We know not only exactly where it is, really good NASA supply photos. The anomalies that are there are unbelievable. And now we found out what's inside. And I'll describe that if you'd like. And that's on the DVD also. And then we have another project. It's called the Exploding Planet Project. And that is, there was actually a planet that exploded. It resided between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, and that's why we have an asteroid belt. This idea was championed by a very mainstream astronomer called Thomas Van Flandern, who was head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics at the Naval Observatory. But his other mainstream astronomers just scoffed at the idea. They just didn't want to deal with the idea that a planet could explode, and how could it explode? But the physical evidence for a planet that exploded, it's just so overwhelming, and he amassed it all together. Well, we decided to go in there and do it with a remote viewing study, and it's unbelievable. It was a knockdown, drag-out study. A planet really exploded, and you really can see all of the data and unbelievable stuff about why, you know, that planet actually did explode. And then we have something that's very timely, also on the DVD, and that deals with the post-2012 Earth changes that so many people are talking about. We had a study where we looked at changes on the planet Earth between the year 2008 and 2013, and that's actually June 1st, 2013. And we were actually originally looking for small climate changes, like maybe a little bit of snowfall difference on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, or perhaps maybe an inch of rise in the seawater and the sea level. But that's not what we found. We found unbelievably huge changes happening in the post 2012 era. So this is after December 2012 up until June 1st, 2013. And if you'd like, if we have time, I can always come back. But if you have time, we can talk something about those. But the changes that we actually saw done under absolutely squeaky clean scientific conditions with total randomization, everything was done right, just is mind-boggling. And so I will leave it up to you, Kevin. That all four of those things are available on the DVD. So if you want to actually get it and know what we're doing, hit the ground running, saying, okay, I get it, that's really the easiest place to start.
Okay, we have to take a break, and we'll All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour. You've missed several parallel universes of information. It's been fascinating, but it's about to become, I think, even more fascinating, because we're now going to talk about something I know every one of you is interested in. You've been sitting on the edge of your seat since Dr. Brown first mentioned the remote viewing results that shows a base on Mars. And in fact, he said we now know where it is and what's in it. So I want to jump right on into that. Dr. Courtney Brown, tell us about Mars.
Okay, Kevin, this is one of the most interesting issues because of two things. We've learned from remote viewing not just about what's going on in a particular base on Mars, but we also learned about how space travel can actually occur, how faster than light space travel can actually occur. Let me just explain as the introduction to how there actually could be a huge facility on Mars, is that when physicists decided that we are the reality that we have and this is it, and they decided there's only one of us, only one version of us, and everything like that, they did something else that was very easy to understand, but it turned out to be grossly wrong. The electromagnetic spectrum, we were talking earlier about everything is energy. Mm-hmm. The electromagnetic spectrum actually is huge. At the low end of it, you get long radio waves, and then you get AM and FM radio, and then microwave, and then you get into infrared, and then you get into the visible light spectrum. And the visible light spectrum is actually a very narrow part of the entire electromagnetic spectrum. And then above that, you get into ultraviolet, and then X-rays, and then gamma rays. And above gamma rays, you get into cosmic rays. And all of these things, like X-rays and gamma rays, it's just high-frequency light. So what the physicists did was they said that superpositions, or physical matter that actually forms, can only form in the electromagnetic spectrum that corresponds with the visible light part. It's a very narrow band. But there's absolutely no scientific reason why you could not get vast superposition ensembles, people, beings, planets, whatever, at other aggregations within the electromagnetic spectrum. You can think of it like a piano keyboard. You can go up an octave and you'll find different things. So why is this important to the operational base on Mars? Because space travel, as we have traditionally understood it, I call horizontal travel. And that means you're at one spot in the electromagnetic frequency, the electromagnetic spectrum, and you're horizontally moving to another place, like Mars, and looking at what's there.
Within that same spectrum.
Well, you're literally in one visible, you're in one spot of frequencies in the visible light spectrum, mm-hmm. and you see Mars, and you're going there to look at it. But space travel, especially with advanced extraterrestrial beings, is not limited to just the visible light spectrum. Space travel means you can shift the spectrum. You can shift to other places in the spectrum, and space travel is possible. When you see scientists tell you, and they'll look you straight in the face, right after this broadcast, you'll go to a scientist and say, you know, what about this, an operational base on Mars? They'll say it's impossible because there's a speed of light, and people cannot travel faster than the speed of light, so there could not be an operational base on Mars because they couldn't get here in the first place. Why is this wrong? It's wrong because if you understand the reality in terms of this quantum mechanical wave function, so that we have our own wave function, our house has a wave function, the universe has a wave function, if you understand that, then what you're actually doing is saying, let us say you and I, Kevin, are in a spaceship in orbit around Earth. Well, that spaceship with us in it has a wave function. It's all made up of superpositions, so we're part of that superposition ensemble of the spaceship. Well, the entire environment surrounding the spaceship is also part of that wave function. And that wave function is defined in terms of distance and time. Those are also defined in terms of frequencies. So what we can say is the following. If you could develop a technology that would keep us in the space capsule, in the spaceship, coherent, the same, so we wouldn't sort of melt away, but change all the other frequencies so that they matched the environmental frequencies of, say, Alpha Centauri, then our spaceship would, in a sense, become a new superposition. But with the environmental elements would no longer be the waves that are associated with orbit around the Earth, but they'd be the waves that are associated with Alpha Centauri. And we would go there. In fact, we could go there virtually instantly if you could simply replace the environmental waves for Earth with the environmental waves of Alpha Centauri. And so this is how the UFOs actually operate, their level of physics. That explains why you often see reports of UFOs that are there on radar and visibly, and then suddenly they go away. They have technology to shift their harmonics such that their space capsule, their ship, the superposition itself, stays together, but the environmental components of that overall superposition ensemble get changed, so they slip back in time or forward in time or up the frequency, up the electromagnetic spectrum or whatever. So space travel is not just horizontal, going from Earth to Mars, but it's also vertical, up and down the electromagnetic spectrum to other realms. Other people sometimes call these other densities, but basically they're moving up octaves to other levels, and that's mm-hmm. what space travel is all about. So when we actually looked at Mars, what we found was two things. First of all, we started with a picture, a NASA-supplied picture, really high resolution. And on our website, farsight.org, you can actually see this picture nicely, really nicely. From the homepage, you just click on the Mysteries Project. It's another banner on the homepage. And there you'll see another link to the Mars Project, which is the project for the operational base on Mars, and it's called an active evidence of active artificiality on Mars. And then if you click on that, you'll actually see the image. Now the image is supplied by NASA JPL Malin Space Science Systems, and what it is, is this is what really caught our attention. It was discovered by a guy called Patrick Skipper, who runs a website called MarsAnomalyResearch.com. And he found a spray. I'm not joking. It's a spray. And if you look at the picture, you'd say, gosh darn, it really is a spray. You see the shadow underneath it and a nozzle, a huge pipe from which the spray is coming out. Mm-hmm. And then the pipe is connected to a pipeline. And the pipeline, you can see it clear as day, goes back to a dome. There's actually two other domes right next to it. And then a little farther south, there's a large, huge dome. And well, if you look at sort of domed rocks here on Earth, they're rough. They're like sandpapery. But these domes look like they're made of a resin material or something. They're shiny. But this spray is really weird. You see the shadow underneath it and everything. Now, we know of no geological processes that can cause a horizontal spray, like a waste discharge off out of a pipe. Now, if you look at geyser like Olds Faithful and Yellowstone, what you get is a vertical spray coming out of the ground, but there's no pipe associated with it. This is a horizontal pipe coming from a pipeline, and the spray is huge, and it looks like it's a waste discharge. And you see the spray, and you see the shadow of the spray, and you see the pipeline and the nozzle clear as day. It looks like a metal nozzle. And you see the domes that the pipeline is going towards. So we looked at this and said, if it wasn't for that spray, it wouldn't be worth it. But that spray is so weird I said, we're going to make a project out of that. So we did it. We sent these military-grade remote viewers with huge track records to that target. Again, everything done totally blind. They knew nothing about anything. And we had given them no off-planet targets like this for years. So they were not expecting anything like this. And what they did is they confirmed, first they confirmed with their remote viewing sessions under totally blind, completely squeaky clean scientific conditions, they confirmed everything that was in the picture. They confirmed the spray, what it was made of, the nozzle that it was spraying out of under high pressure. And again, I cover all of the details in the DVD, the Farsight Experiments. And then the pipeline, and it goes to the dome. Now, as far as them describing the terrain, the nozzle, the spray, the pipeline, the domes, they got everything that was in the picture. But of course, remote viewing is not limited to the picture, so after they got everything that was in the picture, and they didn't even know the picture existed, but the descriptions that they got matched exactly the picture, and you can see it for yourself. Don't just take my word for it. You have to look at the results yourself. And then they went into the domes because they were naturally attracted. They didn't know they didn't know what the target was, but they saw all these things and they saw the domes, so they naturally went into the domes to describe. They just assumed that their job was to get a complete picture of everything that was there. So they saw the domes, so they went into the domes. So they went and saw everything that was going on inside them. Okay. Kevin, are you ready?
I'm ready.
This is a huge complex. It is an operational base that was constructed a long, long, long time ago. The current inhabitants are not the ones who built it. They are occupying it, and they don't fully appreciate the fact that it's not theirs. It was empty, apparently. They came and they started working with it. They're dealing with some technology. They don't understand all of the technology, but they're pretty good with it. But they're having struggles. They don't have all the spare parts, so some of the things don't work exactly the way they're supposed to be working. Huge levels of energy are involved with that, and it is an actual hardship post. It's not an easy post for them. They apparently had a one-way ticket when they got there. They, in their back of their mind, they're thinking maybe they might be able to get back, but they're really not realistically expecting to ever get back to where they came from. And they have normal activities. Some of the remote viewers even describe some of the normal activities, such as they have entertainment time. They do know of Earth and stuff that's going on here, but the real focus is to get that machinery up and going and to get it working. Something is important that machinery is associated with, and they're here to get that machinery up and going. It's the idea that wherever they came from, either in time or space, really needs that machinery to work. And they came here to get it to work. And it involves a huge level of energy, and some of that energy is like coming right off the surface of the domes. And the remote viewers saw it, multiple remote viewers describing the exact same thing, like lightning flashing coming out of the domes. That's basically what's going on there. Now, this is the kicker. These remote viewers really describe everything in low-level terms, and what that means is they don't put everything together in the session. They describe everything in terms of there's a dome, there's people here, this is what they're doing, things like that. But they don't come out with high-level terms like, these are extraterrestrials coming from such and such a whatever place. They don't do that. They just describe what the people are doing and what they're saying. They even describe the uniforms they were wearing. There's a somewhat of a military feel. Not everyone's in the military, but some of them are wearing like white lab coats. Others have sort of military uniforms on. So there's sort of a combination civilian-military sort of combo mix going on. But they didn't say in any of the sessions that these are clearly extraterrestrials. So Glenn Wheaton and Lynn Buchanan really emphasized this to me. They said, you can't say that our viewers saw extraterrestrials because the word extraterrestrials don't show up in those sessions. It's true, they don't. And this is something that was pointed out to me and emphasized, and I agree. It is actually possible that these could be Earth humans. For example, we could have a situation in which crashed ET ships, reverse engineered in Area 51, have been sending people to this base, and these could be Americans. We could. We also have a huge number of launches that occur in Cape Canaveral that are completely off the record. No one ever sees them. No one hears about them. The military sends up projects like this, you know, a major project all the time, and it never hits the news. So maybe it came from something that the military has been doing for a long time. The point is that the data don't say who these people are. I personally think the most likely candidate is that they are extraterrestrials, that they are not from Earth.
But they're human-looking, right?
Yeah, they look human. They look like you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be a few more men than women, and they're there for a long term, and it's sort of a hardship post. Think of yourself living in a submarine for a long, long time. I mean, it's not like they can take a walk outside and go to the park. It's a bit of a hardship post. I mean, they have normal amenities like they have in submarines, but it's not like living in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and they can't come to Earth for whatever reasons and have a day off. So they're there. And it's a very interesting project. So we described it. It's actually under review at a journal, a peer-reviewed journal. So we'll hopefully that the actual data will actually come out in that form. But in the meantime, it is out in the form of the DVD. And all the sessions and all the background information is also available on the Institute's website, except it's all put together in a presentation on the DVD, so you get to sort of see the sort of how it all ties together. But this is a fascinating situation because people have long said in the UFO world that there are bases on the Moon and the Mars, and you could always say, yeah, right, where are they? No, this is a situation where we say this is exactly where it is. It's this spot on this NASA picture, and you look at that picture yourself and you say, if you can actually look at that picture and say that that's not weird, then it may not be possible to convince you of anything. Because that picture is so anomalous. Even the military intelligence people I deal with, they looked at that picture and said, gosh, there really is something screwy with that picture. Look at that thing.
And okay, so let me ask you that. You said, I understand that, you cannot say from the data that they are extraterrestrial.
But that's what I conclude.
Yeah, and that's what I want to ask you. Why do you conclude that?
Because of two things. First, I don't think it's very likely that Americans have been sent out to that particular base. Because if the people were feeling like it's a hardship post, then if they were sent out there with rockets, which I find sort of hard to believe, then it would be a hardship post. But if they were sent out there with reverse-engineered craft from Area 51, then they could get back. The second thing is that some of the descriptions of the people themselves were socially and culturally more advanced than what we are. And what I mean by that is they have a really high level of appreciation for consciousness, nonlinear consciousness. They meditate. They have certain people among them that are, you might consider, very advanced spiritual beings. And it's unlikely from my perspective that the U.S. military would have sent people like that to Mars. They would have sent military grunts, people, scientists and grunts, people that they could, count on in the here and now. But they wouldn't have sent really advanced spiritual beings. Also, they seem to have a technology that blends what we would call spirituality with physicality. They seem to have a technology that's... Now, it could be that if they are Earth humans, and it could be that they simply discovered this technology in the base and are experimenting with it, and that's what the viewers picked up. But I look at them and I say, they act like extraterrestrials. Now, remind yourself, this is, when I talk about extraterrestrials, my own perspective of extraterrestrials is that there is a huge variety of extraterrestrials, and that the there are some extraterrestrials that are not much more technologically advanced than us. But my real emphasis here for really thinking that it's very important that humans understand remote viewing is then we understand where we are within the spectrum of extraterrestrial life. The common perception is that we're the cavemen, we're the primitives, and that's really wrong. If you really understand the remote viewing phenomenon well, what you understand is that our particular brains, being such narrow-band hologram generators, as I described earlier, makes us very special in the way we interact with consciousness. Remote viewing is a specialized technique that we really have to study for. If our brains were genetically designed to be a wider band hologram generators, then it would be very easy for us to have telepathy and other things, and we wouldn't have a whole world out there that's convinced that we don't have telepathy and remote viewing can't exist. It would be easier to understand. So because we have such narrow band hologram generators as brains, what we have is a situation in which when we become physical in our frequency band in the electromagnetic spectrum, when we actualize ourselves and see ourselves, we have a particular spot with such a narrow band in the width of the electromagnetic spectrum in which we almost, we can never fully cut ourselves off, but we almost cut ourselves off from everything else, from who we were, who we really are, our larger self, from our own beings. That's why you get so much polarity in our society. That's why you get fighting so easily in our society, because we cut ourselves off. We don't realize the connectivity between other humans. So we see everything in terms of good and bad. We like we have two eyes, two arms. Everything is polar opposites. If you look at CNN, 90% of the stories are, you know, this disaster happening or that disaster happening. Everything's presented in terms of where are the good guys and where are the bad guys. And so that is a result not of us being deficient. That is a result of the nature of our DNA, the nature of our mix. And so when we decide to come here and to be humans, we are consciously deciding to come to an area in which the nature of consciousness is the most challenging because it's such a narrow band. When you hear stories from various people who, let's say in the abductee realm, or people have said they've interacted with extraterrestrials on UFOs, if you hear stories from them saying that the ETs are very fluent with telepathic communications, that only means that their brains have a wider spectrum, hologram generators. And what that means is not that the ETs there are better than us or that they are superior than us. What it means is that we have a more challenging situation and that we chose to come to this more challenging situation. For example, you can sort of say somebody climbed Mount Everest. Well, you know, there's not much air at the top of Mount Everest and seems like it's a harder thing to do. Well, why did they do it? Because it was the challenge of the thing. So when people come to be humans, it's not because we're deficient. It's because it's a greater challenge. That's why so many ETs look at humans and they look at us with so much admiration. They don't look at us as the primitive cave people. They look at us in awe and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe they're doing that. That is like bungee jumping. That is like jumping out of an airplane with a parachute. That is like so extreme to become human. So we are on the cutting edge of consciousness research. And so when you see so many reports of UFOs and you say, why don't they just land on the White House lawn? It's because the human experiment is so delicate. They're letting us do it in our own time. However, you know, time is a bit running out because things apparently really are going to happen in the very near future. And so they're trying to push us along as quick as possible, not because they feel they're better than us. In fact, they feel much the reverse. They much look at us and say, wow, those humans are amazing.
All right, we have to step away for break, and we'll be back right after this.
My name is Kelly, and I'm calling from Florida, and you are listening to the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on earth. healing medicine for the mind.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Dr. Courtney Brown. When we went away for break, you had brought up that the extraterrestrials are sort of trying to move us along a little faster because so many things, well, as you say, time is running out. But before we explore what may be coming, I have a question about what we have been talking about. Now, you said this base on Mars has been there for a very, very, very long time, and that the current occupants are not the original occupants or builders of this base. How long have these occupants been there?
Oh, that's a good question. They seem to be relatively newcomers, like you can measure it in years. They don't have any, we didn't see any children. So these are adults that, you don't have any really old people and you don't have really any children. So these are middle-aged, from in mid-20s up 30s, 40s, 50s, that type of feeling. So they haven't been there very long, just from looking at it from that perspective. They didn't bring their families, for example. So, but this facility, unambiguously, the remote viewers are very clear on this. This is an absolutely ancient facility. It goes way, way back. And so we're talking about a, you know, we're extending now. Now we're talking about something else, which I've studied differently than this single project, which is the civilization that used to have, that used to exist on Mars. So that's another whole set of questions.
Yeah, well, let's get into that. What about the civilization that used to exist on Mars?
Well, I've actually written a lot about this already. Two books, Cosmic Voyage and Cosmic Explorers. They were both bestsellers in their time. The books are now available as free downloads, PDF forms, and they can be gotten from my personal website, CourtneyBrown.com, www, then just my name, Courtney Brown, CourtneyBrown.com. And those books go into great detail of the ancient civilization that used to exist on Mars. Right now, there are not many people on Mars. There are people on Mars in these underground bases, but there's not a lot. You're not talking, you know, a whole civilization. I would suppose you're talking some thousands. But in the old days, there were lots. The basic stuff that you can find about Mars actually has a lot of physical verification on it as well. The civilization was a very robust civilization. There were lots of oceans. We know now that that Mars was a warm climate, colder than Earth, but still warm and hospitable. A lower atmosphere than ours, but still okay. And there were lots and lots of people there. One thing I have not gone into, right now I'm going to add some things, but I'll tell you when I'm doing it, that I've not published, but hope to do. You know, you can only, we published more than anybody's ever published. The more revelatory stuff comes out of the stuff that we've done than you can find anywhere about anything. But there are things we haven't yet gotten to. And some of the things that I haven't yet gotten to is what caused that planet to explode between Mars and Jupiter. We did determine without any ambiguity that a planet exploded, but I didn't cover yet why it exploded. It looks like it was an act of warfare. It wasn't a natural occurrence. So the data that we have really corroborate with what Thomas Van Flandern, the mainstream astronomer who worked at the Naval Observatory, found also. But there was, at the same time that that planet exploded, there was also a civilization on that planet that we can call Maldek, M-A-L-D-E-K. And there was also a civilization on Mars. So civilization on Mars and Maldek existed at the same time. Maldek popped, it exploded, apparently as an act of warfare. And that really wrecked Mars. Mars was not far away. And if you look at Mars, half of Mars is covered with meteor It was just like someone with a shotgun sprayed it on one side. The other half of Mars is essentially crater-free. But you have craters on one half and not so many craters, hardly any craters on the other half. In addition, on the cratered side is thicker. The crust of the planet is actually thicker by a lot, like some kilometers thicker than the other side. So apparently when Maldek exploded, it was nearby to dump a lot of stuff on the surface of Mars. That was a bad day on Mars. However, apparently that wasn't enough to kill off everybody that was there. They struggled on and they survived on. And then apparently they did what people of Maldek did. They started to fight. What finally finished off the civilization of Mars was a nuclear explosion. And we actually know, some scientists, mainstream scientists, have actually determined exactly where the nuclear explosion happened. Mainstream scientists, 99 and 9/10 percent of them, don't want to go there. But they've seen the data of the radioactive isotopes that are on Mars, and they have the clear, absolutely unambiguous signature of a nuclear explosion. There's a book, I think it's by John Brandenburg, who's a mainstream scientist, worked at all the best places, all the best labs, that's recently out, that literally focuses on the history of Mars and where the actual explosion occurred. And it looks like it happened on the surface, and that apparently finished off the atmosphere of Mars. And that's when it became literally uninhabitable on the surface. So that's when the end of the civilization happened. So what we basically have is two civilizations on Maldek and Mars, and they both did themselves in. And what the extraterrestrials are apparently doing here is helping us so that we don't have the same fate. Apparently, there is some new rule or something that's been devised that, this is what apparently we've discerned, that apparently there's a new rule where we're not going to be allowed to destroy ourselves through nuclear weaponry. Apparently, there have been up to 5 instances so far where nuclear weapons were going to be used and they were stopped from being used. So apparently that's not going to be allowed to happen because there's something coming up. There's something big that we have to get through, and the ETs are not going to allow. See, we live in a very polarized world, and actually I can't get into that now, but there's a reason why we live in a very polarized world, and there's a historical reason. You have to understand who we are, where we came from. But this polarized world that we live in, we see everything in terms of enemies. For example, remember Hugh Everett, who came up with the Other Worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics? Well, after he submitted his dissertation and got his PhD, he was so disgusted by how the physics community treated him, although they have reversed now. I mean, he was just way ahead of his time. He's dead now, but he fortunately did see the beginning of that reversal where they started to embrace him. He had at the University of Texas, he had an all-day seminar where he was just basically worshipped as an idol in the later part of his life. And it was finally the dream come true where people were recognizing what he did. But he left physics after his dissertation because he was so disgusted by how new ideas were being treated, as is typical of all new ideas. And he went into the military establishment, started working on nuclear weaponry, and he was one of the primary people who developed MAD, which is Mutually Assured Destruction, which is the nuclear policy that we followed during the Cold War. You see, we had a bunch of military people that were actually arguing for first strike against Soviet Union and China. Honest, we had a bunch of people that were actually saying, it was like a Dr. Strangelove type of situation, launch now. And he was the one who convinced the policymakers that if we did do a first strike, the effect on the entire planet, that means us, would be devastating, and we would go as well. And we would not be able to contain the fallout. It would be the end of us. It's an extinction-level event. And so it's because of that that he developed this idea of, he helped develop the idea of MAD, which is Mutually Assured Destruction, meaning you avoid nuclear disasters by having weapons on both sides, everyone pointing at each other, and knowing that no one can blink. If anyone actually shoots them, it's the destruction of everybody, mutually. assured destruction, meaning everybody will die. And that's what stopped us from destroying ourselves. Currently, apparently, I'm not referring now to any particular published remote viewing studies, but from my understanding, there's an agreement among the extraterrestrials that they are not going to let us blow each other up. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. They're going to, because they have history in this solar system of that happening twice. And so that's really, anyway.
You have mentioned a couple of times that there's something coming up that we have to get through. What is coming up? Now, we've got about 3.5 minutes till break, and then we'll continue. What's coming
Kevin,
up?
I'll mention just a little bit of it, and the time left for this program, I won't be able to get into all of it. It's the biggest of all of the projects, and again, I do go into the whole thing in the DVD, the Farsight Experiments, but this is the post-2012 Earth changes. Let me summarize for a minute or two, and then I'll talk a little bit more about some of the overall results, but it'll take longer than we've got to explain it, but I'll summarize just a minute or two. We did a project that was originally designed to determine climate change, which we were thinking was going to be very small, between June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013. By that time, we had already understood that this multiple reality stuff was real, and we were having difficulty predicting the future. And we have resolved those issues in our multiple universe project, but at that time we hadn't. And we were wondering if there are multiple realities, could we pick a future of multiple futures and say, a timeline that is characterized by these certain events, what will it look like? And a timeline that's characterized by these certain events, what will it look like at some point in the future? So we said maybe it's going to be difficult for us to determine exactly our reality, but we were wondering if we could determine anybody's reality, somebody's reality. And then by looking at these different timelines and describing the nature of these timelines, we could say, well, where are we? Are we closer to this timeline? Or are we closer to that timeline? So it was a way to try to pick the future and sort of determine where we are based on these timelines. It's sort of like saying you're out in the middle of a field, and you can say, if I go a little bit to the left, you're out in the middle of a field, and you see mountains in the distance, and maybe a distant lake or something, and you say, if I go a little bit to the left, it looks like I'll be running into that type of stuff. And if I go a little bit to the right, it looks like I'll be running into that type of stuff. So we were trying to sort of see if we could perceive the future based on certain characteristics that we might expect to run into. So what we did was we had a whole group of sessions done on locations all over the planet. And we looked at them for the two time periods, 2008 and 2013. But for the year 2013, we picked out two specific timelines, one in which the mainstream scientific community totally refused to acknowledge the reality of remote viewing and any form of extraterrestrial life, even microbial. And the other was in which the mainstream scientific community eventually did, before 2013, did acknowledge, A, the reality of remote viewing and the existence of any form of extraterrestrial life. And the reason is that if they acknowledged the reality of remote viewing, then all of our remote viewing studies would suddenly be on front pages of newspapers, and they'd look at everything else we did, and that may change the nature of human behavior and thus change the nature of the way the climate, how we respond to the planet in terms of the climate. But if they don't do it, don't do anything, then we'd see sort of that timeline. So we investigated those two timelines. We're probably pretty close to the break. Do you want me to?
Yeah, the break's taking over. So we'll pick up there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, more with Dr. Courtney Brown.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on final approach, ladies and gentlemen. That means we only have a few minutes left in tonight's show. I had planned to open the telephone lines. This is just way too interesting and way too important for us to do that tonight. But Dr. Brown, you have mentioned that you would be willing to come back and talk with us again. Am I correct?
Yes, I'd be willing to come back. In fact, I have for a good number of years, about 10 years, we stayed out of all media so that we could just focus on our research. And we made a conscious decision to come out now. And we really are reaching out. We want people to understand this. We want people to understand what research we have been doing, the importance of it. And so it's very important that we have made this commitment to do that. So if you'd like me to come back any number of times, there is no shortage of information that we have to give. I'd be very willing and eager to do that.
Well, I can guarantee you we will have you back and soon. And folks, when we have Dr. Brown back with us, I will open the telephone lines. I apologize to you who have questions and you wanted to call in. In fact, some of you have tried to call in, and I appreciate that. And I apologize to you for not opening the phone lines, but I think you can understand why. Now, we only have 5 or 6 minutes here. But what did you see coming in that we have to get through?
Kevin, I'm going to do something now that I said we should never do. But given the constraints for right now, there's no alternative. And it'll work all right because I'll be able to come back at a later time and explain the project.
Sure.
I'm going to give you some of the results without explaining how we got the results. Now, how we got the results is absolutely so fascinating. I tell you, if you have 1,000 people in an audience in a room and an auditorium, if you explain, if you hear me explain how we got these results, you can hear a pin drop. It is so fascinating. So we'll cover that the next time.
Okay.
But for right now, let me just cover very briefly, because of the minutes that are involved, the types of findings that we got. But I'm asking everybody to forgive me for not going into the details of how we got them, to show the scientific conditions and the fascinating nature of the experiment, how we set it up, and to say that just hold on for a little bit. Still be like in Missouri, the show me state, demand to see it, but give me a chance later on to help further explain it. Again, the stuff is fully explained on the DVD, the Farsight Experiments, but let me just get to it really quickly. We looked at a variety of locations around the planet on for June 1st, 2008 and June 1st, 2013. Vaitupu Tuvalu, an island off of right at sea level out in the south, in the South Pacific. Fort Jesus on Mombasa, Kenya. It's a Portuguese fort, ruins, it's a museum right on the coast in Kenya, in East Africa. The very classic architecture of the Sydney Opera House in Sydney, Australia. And those are great sessions because, you know the person is remote viewing properly because you have to draw the Sydney Opera House the way it looks, and it has that unique, absolute mm-hmm. signature architecture. Mm-hmm. So when the reviewers come in with drawings at that Sydney Opera House, you can see people's mouths drop. Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. We wanted to know if there was still going to be snow at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro in 2013. United States Congress Building, Washington, D.C. It's right at sea level. The Mali International Airport, Mali and the Maldives. The KITV building in Honolulu, Hawaii. We just picked that building out. One of our remote viewers, Dick Allgaier, is a celebrity newscaster, believe it or not, in KITV. And we just wondered about the building. It's sort of near sea level, and it's in Honolulu, and we wondered how it would look in 2013. The Vehicle Assembly Building at Launch Complex 39 at the Cape Kennedy Space Center on Merritt Island, Florida, Cape Canaveral. So, and also Key West in Florida. Well, honestly, going into the study in 2008, what we were expecting to see was hopefully, and we didn't even know if remote viewing could do it, was to notice small changes in the climate. Maybe little snow level changes in Mount Kilimanjaro, maybe a little inch of seawater, rise in the seawater level. We were experimenting to see if we could pick up anything. We did perfect scientific controls with total randomization. No viewers know any of the targets. They didn't know whether they were doing a 2008 or 2013 target. They didn't know anything about anything. And when we did the results, the results were unbelievable. You have to understand the way the experiment was done, which I'll explain next time. It's also in the DVD, of how it was done to realize how amazing this is. Basically, all of the sessions that came in, the results for 2008, and nobody could have known what they were doing when they were doing the sessions. All of the sessions for 2008, everybody were still going to the beach. The tourists were happy. Everything was good. Key West was happy. Everybody was surfing, everything. But for 2013, both timelines was a little bit more severe for the timeline in which the mainstream scientific community was the most adamant about refusing to acknowledge the reality of remote viewing and the existence of any form of extraterrestrial life, even microbial. Both timelines, however, we didn't see small changes. We saw Armageddon. We saw unbelievable changes. We saw, just summarizing in the couple minutes that are left, impacts of what appeared to be large meteors of all things, leading to tsunamis and possible volcanism along the coasts. And these tsunamis were huge. These were not like little tsunamis. These were big tsunamis. Extensive and forceful flooding of coastal areas. Extensive solar radiation, storms, and other severe weather. Well, we don't have time for me to get into details for each of these targets, each of these places, but when I come back, I will. I'll answer whatever questions you want to of what happens to the United States Congress building, things like that, let alone what happens in Sydney, Australia, and Fort Jesus. Anyway, but in terms of the effects on humans, the data suggest massive self-organized relocation from the coastal areas. That's refugees. Notice I said self-organized. There's no National Guard here, no rescue helicopters, nothing like that. The complete breakdown of rescue or other notable governmental functioning, the breakdown of the food supply system, the breakdown of the vehicular transport system, and extensive loss of buildings near the coast. Now, Kevin, you know, what I'm saying is, be from Missouri, say the show me state. Once you understand how these data were collected, and all by themselves, they all bunch up on 2013, and nothing happens in 2008. The 2008 sessions were totally correct. And the viewers had no way to know. When you hear exactly how we controlled for this, you'll know how really the viewers had no way to know whether they were doing anything dealing with 2008 or anything dealing with 2013. The sessions for 2008 were really good. I mean, really good. So I'm in the situation of saying, whoa, maybe I should believe the sessions for 2013 because they all piled up. All these things. You know, I said, where's my inch of sea level? Where's my snow change in Mount Kilimanjaro? We're looking at, like, huge things happening. So when I come back, and for those viewers who want it now, again, the DVD is available now. And all, by the way, all of our stuff is available in terms of the sessions, the scans, so the analyses of these things. They're all available for free on the Institute's website. What we do with the DVD is pull everything together in a way that you have to sit down and look at it in order to really grasp it. We had too many projects that were too significant all at once, and people were just getting overwhelmed. But we nonetheless do have all the data up on our website. We are like from the state of Missouri. Show me. We want to show everybody all the data, show the conditions. And when you have me back at any time, I'll be glad to come back. I will explain what we found in Waitupu, Tuvalu, Mombasa, Kenya, in Sydney, Australia. These are stories that you'll be able to see. I'll be able to describe what people are doing. Mount Kilimanjaro, what happens to the U.S. Congress building, Malé International Airport, what happens in Honolulu, what about the Key West, Florida?
Okay, and we will have you back. And if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring this in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Courtney Brown. He will be back, and we will open the telephone lines when he comes back so that you can call in with your questions or comments, questions and comments, interact with him directly. I just felt that the information was too interesting and too important for us to take calls tonight, but we will when he comes back. My friends call me Steeleye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.